Hey guys, real quick before we jump into this next episode, I want to discuss something with you. I made a decision a couple of years ago not to bombard this podcast with tons of ads or just bombard you with sponsorship. Nothing would drive me more crazy when listening to other podcasts when the first 5 minutes were nothing but ads. So I worked hard not to do that to you. I try to keep the ads to a minimum and keep the podcast as streamlined as possible. So do me a favor. Go check out Phoenix Shooting Bags. Buy yourself a bag. Up your shooting game. You're going to thank me. And if you're not a rifle hunter, go buy yourself a glassing pad. Your butt is going to thank me after spending hours behind the glass. They're awesome. If you use promo code John Stallone, all one word, you'll save 20%. And lastly, please, I know you heard me say it, iTunes, Podbean, go leave us a review. I need the feedback. The ratings help me reach more people, and it helps me keep this free. So do me a favor, check out Phoenix Shooting Bags, and go leave us a review. Thank you. Let's roll into this next episode.
Hi, welcome to the Interviews with the Hunting Masters, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. Today we're going to talk a little bit about hunting mule deer in Arizona. I think mostly we'll talk a little bit about the North Country. We have a Arizona guide kind of a local hero, so to speak, on with us, and his name is Ben Sandel. What's going on, Ben?
Oh, what's up, man? Yeah, that's quite the intro there. But yeah, no, dude, it's good to be here. Good to be talking to you.
Got a lot to live up to.
Yeah.
So before we get into introducing who you are and all this stuff, I want to discuss something with the listeners. I got my first bad review last week, and somebody gave me a one star. It was my first time getting anything other than a five in 10 years of doing this podcast. And they complained that I said that I had the worst audio. My audio is horrible. And this just made me think about, because you and I had some difficulties getting this going today. People don't understand that I'm talking to guys like you live in Flagstaff, and I'm not exactly sure where you live, but you know, you may not have awesome internet service. And
oh, I don't. You know, yeah, there's no doubt.
Yeah.
I don't.
So you know what it is? So like, I have to get creative sometimes. So right now, Ben and I are doing this on the telephone, and I'm recording the telephone conversation. So it's going to sound like two guys talking on the phone. It's not going to have that studio quality like when you listen to Meat Eater podcast or Gritty Bowman. They do theirs in person. I try not to limit myself to the people that I run into or can meet up with. I want to talk to guys from all walks of life and doing all. I mean, there's been times where I'm talking to guys that are in the mountains and, you know, we're trying to have a conversation and he's standing on one foot and holding his finger to his nose just so he could get enough service to talk to me. You know, so just wanted to put that out there, before you pass judgment on my sound quality. It has nothing to do with my recording equipment but you know, you got to understand that not everybody that I do podcasts with has podcasting equipment to sound awesome.
So, well, even then, anyway, with a podcast. Yeah. it's the information that's valuable. I mean, nobody's sitting here listening, you know. I don't think. Yeah, I mean, as far as sound quality, it's not something that they're using to put themselves to sleep. You know, as long as you can hear the information, that's what matters.
Apparently, to this guy, the sound quality matters more than
hate.
But anyway, I just wanted to put that out there. So I apologize if the sound quality is not amazing in this episode. So anyway, well, Ben, why don't you give us a little rundown about yourself and what you do?
Yeah. So I was born and raised in Arizona. I was born in Cornville, Arizona, small little town south of Flagstaff. I spent my whole life hunting, you know, pretty much just grinding ridges, hiking like crazy, just, yeah, just what my dad, the best that he knew as far as hunting. And moved up to Flagstaff straight out of high school, and have been up here pretty much ever since. And I just hunting has just become, I don't know, part of me. It's just what I do. I started guiding pretty early on for a few different outfitters, and teamed up with High Point Outfitters here towards the end of my really guiding career. I haven't really taken on a lot of clients, and mainly that's just because time, you know, it's like not having enough time, committing the amount of time that, you know, for each hunter. It's hard for me to take a hunter if I don't have the time to scout for that unit or whatever it may be. So I just tend to just hunt for myself and hunt with whoever is close to me that has a tag. So, but I enjoy it, every bit of it. And yeah, it's part of just what I do.
Awesome. So you had a really good season so far. And I want to touch on that and maybe get the story about it later. But just to preempt what we're going to talk about here, you got a buck in the early season. You drew a bull tag and you killed a lion. And that was just August and September, basically, right?
Yeah, just actually last weekend for the bull and the lion. And then, yeah, the deer was the first weekend of the over-the-counter archery tag here in Arizona. So, yeah, it's been pretty packed couple weeks.
Nice. You know what? Screw it. Let's do it differently. Let's go here. I want to hear the story. Let's hear the story of both of them.
Okay.
For now.
All right.
Then we'll
so
go into some questions.
So, pretty much what – yeah. So, all right. So I don't know. I'm sure a lot of your listeners are Arizona residents. If you're not, I'm sure that you've heard John talk a lot about the over-the-counter opportunities that Arizona has, quite a lot of them. That's something that I've always taken advantage of and have been successful a few times. But this year particularly, it was pretty crazy because across the whole board this year for Arizona, it was just really dry. The monsoons never really rolled in. And I take a lot of time and preparation as far as the deer hunt goes, preparing to really pattern the deer, get to know what they're doing. But they completely changed everything they did for where I was hunting. And, the mule deer was pretty cool story. But we spike camped in. And it was quite a hike, but we spike camped in for a couple of days, and I passed up a couple bucks, small bucks, early on.
Mm-hmm.
And the second day came, and the first morning, it was just a grind, like the whole time. I actually did a video of it, but the first morning was just a grind, and couldn't even, just had no idea where the bucks had gone. They completely changed their patterns, and kind of like our last Hail Mary, because we were running out of water, just being so dry. We packed water in, but didn't bring enough. And so we were last ditch effort. And I ended up glassing up the bucks, in an area that was totally different, and was able to slip in and get a shot. And luckily I was able to get a follow-up shot, but, man, it was pretty awesome. It was my biggest mule deer that I've killed. I've killed a few coos bucks and a few mule deer with my bow, all velvet. I've never killed a hardhorn buck, which has kind of haunted me.
I'm the exact opposite. Yeah. I mean, I shouldn't say that I haven't killed velvet. I have, but nothing big.
That's kind of like, I don't know. I have, my wife calls it velvet wallpaper because I have like a whole over the counter wall in my house that's just velvet and mule deer and a couple coos deer that I've killed on the over-the-counter tag. And, you know, I'm never going to pass up the opportunity to a good mature deer. And But it kind of does, you know, takes me out for the December hunts. And I've always too scared to pull the trigger on a buck in January because I'm afraid I won't, you know, it'll take me out of the draw and not get a, you know, a strip tag or something. So I don't really hunt too hard in January, but yeah. So, but yeah, I don't know what it is. It's just, and I just love velvet mule deer and love velvet coos deer. And I just love that time of year. It's just so fun. You know, you wait all year for hunts and then they come and it's like, but you know, then they're over before you know it. So,
yeah.
But, yeah, that was, your mule deer was a pretty cool experience. But the elk hunt, I only had one weekend for the mule deer and it just was fortunate enough to capitalize on it. But, and that elk hunt, I put so much time into scouting, and when the elk, you know, you can find them in the summer and they're bachelored up, they're running with different bulls, you know, you can run cameras, you can glass them, you can do all this stuff, but especially rut hunts, like everything that you do before September 13th is out the door. And it literally, like, you find and the crucial time for scouting for elk for the rut is literally the week before. And I knew that. I think I was more out looking just because I was so excited. But it pretty much all of my scouting went out the door. And I knew what bulls were around, but I had, you know, no idea where they went. And so anyway, the week before the hunt was just hectic, man. It was just crazy trying to locate, you know, the type of bull I wanted. And and it got to be where it was like super stressful. And I started putting so much pressure on myself up until the day of the hunt that I wasn't looking forward to the hunt. Honestly, John, I was like, I can't have fun. I'm so concerned about, you know, finding the biggest bull and I don't have enough time. And I ended up finding great bulls. And then I start getting, you know, all stressed out. Like, how am I going to do it? There's so many other hunters that are going to be hunting in here and it's just going to be a nightmare. And so the first few days of my hunt weren't fun, which is kind of sad to say. Just the fact that, you know, the unit I had takes 9 points to guarantee an archery bull tag. So I waited 7 years for the tag. And, you know, to say that the first few days of your hunt aren't fun, like, that's just, you know, it kind of sucks. But, yeah. So, yeah, then you know, I'm just, it didn't have a whole lot of success. I was hunting specific bull, and this bull that I was hunting was a giant double sword, bull, just a monster. And, I was hunting that specific bull, but he was so hard to pattern. I don't know if it's because of hunt pressure or just because of what he did. He was hard to glass. That's my style of hunting. I like to glass, see what I'm going after, and then slip in. Another thing too that I like to do is when the first weekend is always a zoo, and it's just so usually the pressure is just crazy. So I like to get up on a hill, even if I have a tag, and I just like to watch the circus happen, you know, and then try to pattern the elk and see what they do when they blow out, and then once I kind of figure out what they do, even when they blow or when they bust, or say that they do bust, I see them going to draw. That's when I like to slip in and take advantage of the opportunity. But, after hunting this specific bull, it just got super stressful. I couldn't find him. Then I'd find him and I wasted, you know, just tried to pattern him for the first 2 or 3 days. But he was getting blown out so much. And I don't know, you know, we all have wives, you know, those of us that do have wives,
right.
You know, they tend to give us, you know, some special, counsel, when we seem to be, you know, straying from, you know, what we know is right. But, Yeah, she's just pretty much telling me, she's like, this is your elk tag and you're not having a good time. And she goes, I'm going to, you know, you need to just stop. You need to forget about this bull. You need to forget about what you're doing and you need to refocus and remember what all this is about. So she told me to take my kids. And that's something I always wanted to do, was take my kids hunting and be with them. And it wasn't so much about me killing the biggest bull. It was, you know, so I took my kids. They became my video crew. And so we started going. And that's when I started actually getting close. And I had some really cool experiences with my kids, you know, running the video camera. So that was kind of the turning point for when things really started to turn around for the hunt. So I had a buddy come out, my buddy John Adams, and then another friend of mine, Jay Randall, and put them up on one of the Glasson Hills where we've been seeing this bull. And they get up there and you know, they send me, they're like, hey, man, we just glassed up a lion. And it was actually week before I glassed up two lions, and I took a friend and he had a boy. We went and killed one of those lions. And so I was just like, what the heck? We're glassing up lions like crazy. So, nice. He was like, you should come try and kill this lion. And went up in a tree and I was like, oh, heck yeah, I'll try and make something happen. And so I was kind of hesitant. I didn't want to bring dogs in there, but I also wanted to make sure the lion didn't get away. And so I actually called up a buddy. He had a couple dogs, but I was like, just bring one or two dogs just in case I wound this lion and we need to track it or, you know, say it jumped out of a tree. We just need to get it back up. And so he brought out a couple dogs and we started slipping in, and sure enough, the lion jumped, and the video is just awesome. But the dogs run the lion down and they're just on the ground. And there was actually two lions in the tree. And
oh, no shit.
Both the dogs split up and they're just hauling ass after these other two, each lion. And
wow.
Both dogs catch both lions separately. and my buddy is freaking out because he's worried his dogs are going to get killed.
Yeah.
And
one dog against a lion.
Yeah, one dog against a lion.
Not a fair fight.
So he's pulling off one of the dogs off the lion and, you know, and I'm running up there, and anyway, that it's all on the ground, and so it's all happening super quick, and I was able to get one of the lions down, but a young Tom. And anyway, the other lion ended up getting away, and the dogs, they were too, you know, I don't know much about lion hunting or dogs, but I think once they get on a scent, they get hot. You know, and they're on that scent. And then once that lion's dead, it's hard for them to get going on a new scent.
I don't know.
That's what my buddy was telling me, but I don't know anything about lion hunting with dogs.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I'm all stinky, smelling like mountain lion. And by this time, it's about 11 o'clock. And so I rush home. And I'm like, I got to get this lion stench off of me.
Right.
So I'm getting a shower and I'm like rushing to get back for the evening hunt. And luckily, you know, I wasn't hunting too far from home. So I rushed back out and there was it was just kind of like a crazy experience. Cause I was just the whole time during my summer scouting in this area, I remember that the elk like to bed in a certain spot. And and it's an area that you can't really glass. And so I just, you know, I was like, oh, you know, I'm going to go slip in there. And I had my buddies get up on the hill again. Mm-hmm. So I went and slipped into this area you couldn't really glass. And I'm just kind of creeping. And I use sneaky feet, like sneak tech.
Yeah.
Sneaky feet.
Yep.
And
that's what I use.
No, dude, I'm telling you, Western hunting. Like if you Western hunt and you spot and stalk, like you have to have sneaky feet or your feet just get raw because you have to take your shoes off. One of the two. So I'm like, should I put my sneaky feet on? And I was like, no, don't put them on. It's, you know, you're just going right over here. And So I just kind of was creeping, and I was like, oh, maybe I should put my GoPro on. And I was like, nah, I'm not going to put my GoPro on. I'm just going over here because I was trying to get elevated to glass. But I knew that this area that was right below this little knob was a bedding area. And as I'm slipping up and slipping into this the little rise, I hear this bull bugle off to my left. And I was like, man, that bull is close. So I set my tripod down, and I just, you know, so I have just my bow. And I see this cow. As soon as that bull bugles, I set my tripod down. I look up to my left, and I see this cow's head pop out. And it was just like, it was kind of a miracle because I, you know, he kind of let me know that they were coming into the opening. And so they just all started filing through. And they, you know, they're kind of working their way through the cedar trees, and they were 70 yards. And I feel comfortable to take 70 yard shots. You know, I felt good about it. And so the bull never came out. And in fact, he bugled again, and he was beyond the cedar trees and beyond the cows. So I was like, oh, okay. And so I kind of slipped up a little bit, worked my way about 20 yards, just kind of trying to creep. The cow started feeding through another opening. And this opening was 50 yards, 50 to 55 is where the cows were. And so the bull, I hadn't seen the bull at this point, but I knew which bulls were in this area. I knew that pretty much every herd bull was a shooter. And so I'm kind of just posted up, and I can see the bull and his shiny horns because the sun's still up. Just I could just still picture it in my mind. It was awesome. But I could see his horns coming through the cedar trees, and I just knew. I was like, oh, I'm smoking. I'm going to shoot that bull. And so he starts working his way, and, you know, and I – I just, you know, remained silent. I didn't want the elk to know I was there, cause they were still cooperating with, you know, with where I was. So he was kind of working his way through, and, I draw my bow, and the bull steps out, and he's about 90 yards. And I'm like, gosh, and I didn't want to take that shot. So, I let my bow down, the elk filed through. And they started walking away, and then I was like, man, the bull ended up turning them, coming straight back to me, which I was like, man, I'm going to have to tail these elk. And the bull turned them and came kind of straight back to me, and they started feeding right in front of me at 40 yards.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe this is happening. And the bull kind of disappeared behind the trees. The cows kind of fed out, and the bull still was like lagging behind. And I'm like, man, what the heck? Where's this bull at? And so the cows kind of fed off. The last cow kind of cleared to where I couldn't see her. And so I crept up another 15 yards, and I look off to my left just in time to see the bull start to walk through this opening. And I drew my bow, and the opening was 68. And when I drew my bow, he caught slight movement, but he just turned and he just ripped a bugle, just like, wah, you know. And I'm just, oh, gosh, and I'm settling my pin, and I could just – and I shoot, and I just – my arrow just – as flying through the air as he's finishing his bugle, and as his bugle finishes, my arrow just buries into him, and I knew it was just a great shot.
Nice.
Yeah. So I called the wife, and I'm like, oh, get out here. And so, yeah, the rest is history. After that, it was definitely an awesome hunt. But
hell yeah.
Yeah, it was cool. Way cool. Other than we came home to a drunk guy passed out in our bathroom that night.
So what?
It was crazy. Dude? Yeah, and that's what – John, I'm serious. Like, this is part of the miracle because we had – like, I knew that the shot was good. I was so confident in the shot that I was like, let's bring all the kids, I got four kids and my wife, and I was like, why don't you bring all the kids over and, you know, we'll go do this tracking. And I'm telling you, if all this stuff didn't happen, my wife would have been home when this intruder came in, and, you know, whether she would have killed the guy or whatever, it would have been a really bad situation. So, you know, we're pretty blessed, really fortunate that it all worked out the way it did. And it just, yeah, the guy, I guess he was at a wedding and got dropped off at the wrong house, you know. And So the way it worked out was just a miracle, because my wife would end up killing this guy. The poor guy just got dropped off at the wrong house in an Uber. And yeah, it was crazy. It's been a crazy, crazy last few weeks.
Man, that's a good story, man. I like it. I like it. That's a hell of a way. You know, you were talking about in the beginning how you weren't having fun, and I'll tell you what, man. My last, I don't know, 5 or 6 trips have been that way. That pressure that we put on ourselves, and I think a lot of it comes from freaking social media, to be honest with you.
Oh, dude, so bad.
It's like you want to perform so bad to show the rest of your peers and your whatever that you can perform, you know? And it's like you put a bunch of fucking pressure on yourself, and God, I swear.
Oh, yeah.
Enough to put you in therapy after a while, I'll tell you. The more I talk to guys that are kind of like, I hope this doesn't sound conceited, but like, you know, at your level or our level of hunting, where we, you know, want to get a certain type of animal and be, you know, do it a certain type of way and so on and so forth. But there's so much extra added pressure. And I think a lot of it's just made up in our heads. Like we think we're being pressured by the outside world, but it's really just, it's all us. And I've been struggling with that a lot, man, a lot.
Well, and I'll tell you, like, 1,000% agree with you. And I was thinking about this during my elk hunt. And one thing I've hunted my entire life is elk, calling elk, whatever. And mm-hmm. you know, I can get into a whole nother podcast of calling elk and how people are turning it into what it is. But one thing that a hunter has is somebody that's a successful hunter. They have a killer mm-hmm. instinct. Okay. It's just like something that you mess up enough times, or you get out in the woods enough times, you spend enough time around animals, that you end up developing this instinct. That's just like, you get into a couple of buddies of mine, we call it kill mode, where it's just,
right.
Okay, time to get the job done. And
yep.
when your mind, and this is what I found, when your mind is clouded by all these other things, these pressures and the bullshit, you know, that's just got you all messed up. It makes it to where, like, you can't, like, I can't think straight when it comes to how I know how to kill. So mm-hmm. it actually messes me up more. I put all this pressure on myself, and what it does is it makes it to where I don't become that, you know, that instinct is completely blocked, that killer instinct. And knowing what to do, because you're just constantly like, oh, questioning yourself and this and that. Your mind mm-hmm. isn't clear, and it makes it to where you're less effective as a hunter. And
so true.
I 100% believe that. And I know it's like,
so true.
Man, when you're out there, it could really mess you up.
Yeah, crazy, crazy. I mean, the mind controls everything, man. So if you're not right up there, the rest ain't going to fucking work. No matter how much you practice, no matter how much you work out, no matter how much you scout or whatever, it's still, yeah, if you're not right up top, it doesn't. So
that's right. Yeah, for sure. So it was a good learning experience for me this year. Luckily it didn't take me all the way up till day 10 or day 12 or whatever to figure it out,
mm-hmm.
you know, only day 4, but from day 4 nice. On, I was finally able to hunt and have a good time. And it was a great hunt. It was a great experience.
That sounds like an amazing, amazing story, man. Well, let's jump in some of these questions. I kind of, introduced that we were going to talk about mule deer. Why don't we talk a little bit about mule deer behavior, and give me some characteristics that you can count on,
okay,
and how you use them to your advantage to scoring a buck in archery season.
So one thing that is crucial for me, so one thing that I've noticed is that as far as mule deer behavior – I do use salt, just white salt, plain salt, and that's just an early on pattern. When they're growing or early in the season, they can pattern to salt for some reason. I don't know what it is, but I think it has something to do with just their horn growth and what the, you know, pulling that out of their body. So they pattern to salt all the way up until about the second week of the over-the-counter hunt, they'll pattern to salt. So that's why I usually take advantage of the first weekend whenever I, you know, have deer that are patterned to salt or around salt. So that's one way that I've, as far as, you know, hunting mule deer. Coos deer are very much the same way as far as patterning the salt. The hardest problem that we have in Arizona is you know, if you want to try and pattern mule deer or coos deer to salt, you have to find a way to get away from the elk. Because elk will completely destroy, you know, whatever salt you place out there.
Right.
So, and so that's one way that
and
I
and cattle too
to be. And cattle, yeah, cattle, yeah, for sure. But I find that's been beneficial to me. I'm a big time, big glassing. I always glass from a tripod. That's like my number one way. I have killed coos deer and a mule deer from a tree stand. Actually, two mule deer from a tree stand coming into salt or water. But I like to glass. They typically tend to bed 4 or 5 general areas. If I can glass them, that's great. And if I can't glass them, then I go into stealth mode and I get my sneaky feet on and I just cruise through those bedding areas right, you know, about the time that they go into bed. Try to catch them coming into those places. And that's, you know, that's, yeah, just a few ways that I've found a lot of success doing
that.
Well,
let's talk about that a little bit.
Coming in our beds. Yeah.
What is it that you're looking for? Okay, so let's talk about the habitat that you're hunting first. What type of habitat are you looking for to hunt in? And then tell me what's bedding cover to you in those habitats?
So
in that
I really like scrub oak, cliff rose, and you know, oak. I love hunting areas like that. As far as habitat, typically I'm looking at feed. Acorn crop is huge, especially, you know, coos deer, mule deer. Sometimes the scrub oak has the acorn crop, sometimes just the oak has the acorn crop. So I hunt a lot of that. I have hunted southern Arizona a lot, mainly for coos deer. But as far as, you know, the Ocotillos and all that stuff, that's, you know, that's kind of where I'm like, when it comes to feed and coos deer, that's what I'm looking for is the Ocotillos. There's so many more elite coos hunters than me that hunt that stuff. And I'm kind of, you know, I could be novice when it comes to southern Arizona, but up here, you know, northern Arizona, a high desert, that's kind of what I'm looking for, is that kind of habitat. So
yeah, is that like basically just at that like transition where you don't, I mean, there could be elk there, but not as many.
Yeah. Yep. I try to get out of the elk as much as I can when I want a pattern deer. There are giant deer that are in the elk habitat, but they're super harder to pattern. Like there was a buck this year that everybody wanted to kill, but you know, great buck, double drops, you know, but he was just one of those bucks that, I feel like I could have maybe made something happen if I hadn't killed and I was dedicated to hunting him, but it's one of those just grinds, you know, just like the elusive deer that seems like he just floats around and shows up like, you know, wherever he wants. They always have a pattern. Like they always do something. Sometimes they'll do it in the middle of the night, but they're going to do something and they're going to be somewhere during the day. It's just figuring out, you know, where they run and what they do. But mule deer, they don't, I find that they don't bed in the exact same place every day, but mm-hmm. they rotate the bedding areas and they rotate to those places regularly. So that's kind of what I have found with those deer. But yeah, I mean, I just get up on a big hill and I glass and I find them. And then I just mm-hmm. focus in that area and trying to just rotate my vantage points to try and pick them up every day until I feel like I have a gist for what they're going to do. And then I slip in. So many people are, oh, let's find them. And then let's bomb in after them. And you got to do that mm-hmm. when it's public land, because you don't want to miss the opportunity of being able, you know, once you see them, you want to use that opportunity, you know, because you might not ever see them because somebody could blow them out, you know. But right. if you got deer that you don't think a lot of people are watching, which is possible in Arizona, I just really try to watch them and figure out what they're doing and then slip in.
Nice. Can you describe to me what bedding cover looks like in that, or bedding areas look like in that type of habitat that you're looking at? What are you looking for?
I'm looking for like little benches.
Okay.
If it's like kind of like steeper terrain, I look for areas that have, you know, benches, little north slopes, cause I spend most of my time hunting in August. So it's scorching hot sometimes. Well, for me, it's scorching hot. 95 degrees is scorching hot.
That's scorching hot for me too. Even though I live in the valley.
But
anything over 80 is scorching hot for me.
Oh, dude, I'm right there with you. I say the exact same thing. Yeah, I wear boots to work. I want to be comfortable. So, so like north slopes, little benches, gradual, when you get steep terrain, those deer, well, specifically mule deer, they like to bench. Mm-hmm. They like to bed on those benches. Coos deer have been a little bit, coos deer do the exact same things more, I think, than mule deer. But
they seem to be a little bit smaller, tighter
yeah,
rotation,
exactly.
And tighter pattern.
Yeah. So like if, for instance, one of the bucks that we were hunting, coos bucks, he would show up on our camera every week, 2 weeks, once a week, the middle of the night. And so we would move our camera 200 yards and set it in a different area. And then we get that buck every 4 days. And then we move our camera a little bit more, and we wouldn't get him at all. So then we know to move it the other way. And we ended up moving our camera to where we were able to figure out where this buck was primarily living his whole life. And so we would get it to the point where we got our camera in a place that he was coming in every day between 8 o'clock and 10:30 in the morning. And then he would come back. He would come in twice a day, you know, late morning and early evening. And so we're like, okay, this is pretty much where he's bedding is in here. And that's the way kind of coos deer were. And he was doing that for 4 years. Anyway, we ended up taking him, but coos deer, man, they're totally different breed.
That's
super,
for sure.
I have a lot of respect for coos deer and what they, you know, the type of hunting that they are. You know, it's, my buddy is a huge coos deer hunter. The guy that I archery deer hunt, huge coos deer hunter, and he's really good at it. And that's because he has a lot of patience, and he patterns the deer, and he knows exactly what they're going to do. So
that's awesome.
I have zero patience.
Me too, man. I hate sitting. You know, I do it, but I hate it. It's just,
gosh,
it's one of those things.
It's so funny because I can go back east. I told you I was going back to New York. I could go back east and sit in a tree stand for 12 freaking hours. No problem. You put me anywhere out west where I know that I can go glass and stalk or do something different, and I have zero patience to sit.
Oh, I know. Yeah, it's just because, I don't know, man, there's something about glassing and seeing them, and, you know, I think for me,
the thing is, like, if I know, like, if I sit in a tree stand in New York that I'm going to see, if I sit at 12 hours, I'm going to see probably 15, 20 deer, you know?
Yeah.
Most of them are going to be does, maybe a couple little bucks or whatever. But if I sit 15 hours in Arizona, I'm lucky if I see a bird, you know? Like,
that's right. That's right.
You could go 3 days. You could, like you were just talking about, you know, the buck comes every 3 days or whatever to water or whatever. You can go days and days without seeing a single animal, you know? And that's just rough. That's rough to me.
Yeah, I don't like that way. The whole time I'm doing it, I'm like, oh, what's going on right over on that ridge or what's going on right over here? I just can't do it. But, I mean, when you're eastern hunting, what else are you going to do? You know, when you're eastern hunting, you can – I don't know. I'm not familiar with it, but stalking around
still,
is
– You could still hunt. And there's guys that do it, still hunt. You could do tracking. There's a lot of things you could do. Tracking is actually kind of fun, especially if you're doing it in the snow. And still hunting is, I mean, that's, I grew up still hunting. So when we were kids, we didn't stand hunt. We posted, you know, every once in a while, we'd stop and hang out for 30 minutes or so and then, you know, move up the ridge or whatever. But, it's different.
Well, that reminds me, when I was a kid, we would, that's how I was brought up, was still hunting. And we called it every thick bench that had trees on it where elk and deer would bed, we would call it the dance floor. And when we would say, let's go still hunting, it was like, let's go dancing. And what we would do is we'd do the 20 step. It was the 20 step stop and drop. So you go 20 steps, you'd stop and you'd get down and you look under the trees and you look and you just creep 20 steps and you stop and you drop. And that's kind of how I grew up hunting. And then I discovered binoculars.
Yep, for sure. I remember my first few years of hunting out here. I've been living in Arizona now since 91. So
that's a while.
Going on. It's going on 30 years pretty soon. But when I first moved out here, I mean, I still hunted for deer. And I had some success, you know.
Yeah.
Forkies and spikes and shit, but
yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's like, oh, or you shoot a buck and he looks a lot bigger and then you walk up to him and you're like, oh, there was a bigger one, they're running away, or you know, when it's spur of the moment like that, you end up shooting deer you don't really intend to shoot.
Yeah. So another question I have is, what would you say the most three critical factors that contribute to your success? What are the three things that you do? Like three things that are like definitely what contribute to your success?
I would say if it doesn't suck, it doesn't reward you. That's always one thing that I tell myself. And that just pretty much is attributed to just hard work, just being in the field, getting out. So like if I don't ever say to myself, wow, this sucks, then I don't feel like I'm working hard enough to be successful when it comes to hunting, especially like the over-the-counter hunts. So there's a lot of times that I'm like, why the heck am I doing this? You know, like, how is this fun? And then, you end up finding success and you're like, man, that was so worth it. Glassing is definitely 1,000%. Glassing is for sure one of them. And knowing my gear. So gear is, when it comes to, I'm a big believer in you get what you pay for. And that's one thing that I won't ever cut short is my hunting gear and shooting equipment, optics, you know, all that stuff. So, those are the major things that I would say bring the most success.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, man. That's crucial. Good gear. I mean, not that you can't get done because there's guys that do it every year in, you know, Walmart camo and Bushnells and, you know, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
But
when I have different, you know, I think that, yeah, I've been successful in like just like street clothes or whatever. I think it's like the mindset the camo gives you that makes you successful, you know, like put you in this hunter mode. But yeah, no, I know that people, you know, my dad's one of them. He's just the old school, you know, just like, I think I bought him his first pair of decent binoculars and their pair of Vortex, you know, their cheaper brand or cheaper style. And, you know, he's still rocking them, and he does just fine with them. And so you don't have to have those things, but I will say that, like, if hunting is your passion and hunting is what you do and what you want to do, that's where if I have extra money, I'm figuring out how I can get the right gear. 'Cause once you get the right gear, I think I just hate being limited. You know, that's my thing. I don't want to be limited by my gear.
Oh yeah, I know. I'm with you. Oh man. So do you have any stories you could share with us that kind of, where you learned a lesson about hunting deer, or something that was like an aha moment? I hate to use that terminology, but for you, where you figured out something about deer hunting, or?
Well, figured out about something about deer hunting?
Yeah.
Something
where you learn, maybe the first time you figured out how to move the cameras or whatever. I mean, it doesn't matter to me. Something that maybe has a teaching moment to it, I guess.
I mean, there's so much. Something specific in how I learned about spot and stalk coos deer. I don't know if are you specific to coos deer or mule deer. Does it matter?
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
We're talking deer.
So one of the stories that I have is a buddy of mine, we alternate who is first shooter where we hunt for over the counter. And it's every year it switches. So this year it was we call it my up. So it was my up this year.
Nice.
I love hunting mule deer. He's a big coos guy. So who's ever up it is, they decide which buck they want to target. And so this particular year, my buddy was after this typical 115 inch 3-point coos deer. And so it was, so that was the buck he wanted to target. There was several other good bucks that we had seen, but that was the one. And so what we did, and he's taught me a lot about hunting. My buddy of mine, his name is Jeremy Gardner. He's taught me a ton about hunting. And one in particular, this was a big learning experience for me, and I think for both of us, because we would watch this deer, and he was in an area that we had never hunted before. So we didn't know the area very well. We didn't know the terrain. We didn't know the bedding areas and, you know, what they did. So we had to relearn, and we had to learn all these, this deer's pattern in just a few days.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would go every morning, and we'd glass him, and we would watch him. And then we would make notes, mental notes, or, you know, and then we would go in the evening and we'd watch him and glass him. We did this for 3 days, every morning and evening. We'd go in the middle of the day, we'd glass him and watch him and see where he went into bed. If we could see him, just see if he gets up, see what he does. So we watched it for 3 days. We only had 4 days to hunt. And so we literally spent 3 days just trying to figure the buck out. That's what we did. And every day he would do something, and that was very consistent and similar. He didn't always feed in the exact same place. He didn't always bed under the exact same tree, but he would do something every day that was the exact same thing. And it was walking by, he would walk within bow range, whether it was 10 yards or 70 yards of a particular tree. So on day four, and we noticed that he would mostly walk by this tree in the afternoons. He would sometimes cruise by there in the mornings, but we noticed also the wind was bad. So wind is like huge when hunting anything. If you don't have the wind right, you might as well go home. So he would walk by this specific tree, and on day four, the afternoon when we had to leave, he just like, I'm going to just sit in that tree. So he slips in, and I'm just watching, and he slips in and he climbs up in this tree, and he just waits The wind is perfect because we know what the wind does in the afternoon. You always try to get the prevailing winds right. So the wind's good, and he just sits there and he waits and waits and waits. And in the meantime, I'm glassing up other deer. And a lot of times people will be like, oh, I'm going to go after that deer, or I'm going to go after that deer or whatever. But you just stay focused. And he sat in that tree, and that deer walked 43 yards from that tree. It's not that we had a salt there. It's not that we even had water there. It's just we know that that's where he walked. And he just slipped an arrow in there, 43 yards, and heart shot, and fell over dead. So I think that so many people get so caught up in oh, there's a deer, let me go get it, which is good. But when you're targeting a deer, it's very important to watch that deer, know what he does, learn everything you can about him and the amount of time you have, and then make your move. I do know that deer's patterns will, as the hunt goes on, the deer, they quit growing their velvet, and their feed changes, their patterns change as they get out of their velvet, or they completely fully grow. So that's why we try to do it early on in the hunts. But that was a pretty big learning experience for me as far as archery coos deer.
Yeah. Hunting.
And I know that mule deer are a little bit harder to pattern that way. So we tend to make moves as we see mule deer because, you know, they could be in this bedding area or that bedding area depending on which day it is. That's a good learning experience.
It takes a big leap of faith to do stuff like that. It's like you've seen it happen 3 days in a row.
Yeah.
But still in the back of your mind, you're like,
there's
no way he's going to do it again. There's no way he's going to do it again, you know?
Yeah. So yeah, that doubt, having doubt in your mind, I mean, it's easy to have, but you got to block it out. You just got to stick with the plan.
Well, awesome, man. Why don't you tell us where our listeners can check you out, anything you got going on, or where they can find out more about you?
So I have a YouTube channel. It's Ben Sandal Lifestyle. Just type in Ben Sandal Lifestyle, or just type in Ben Sandal. You'll see my latest mule deer hunt on there, as well as one of the lion hunts that we recently did. And then I'll have my elk hunt uploaded. I unfortunately didn't get the shot on video, but I have lots of great footage and stuff that I'll be uploading there. Also on Instagram at Ben Sandal, Ben_Sandal on Instagram. So
awesome.
But yeah, man, it's been great talking to you. This has been a good time.
Likewise. Appreciate you coming on and sharing your experiences with us and some knowledge. I think there's a lot of good takeaways on that conversation. So we'll definitely catch back up with you. Maybe have you on before next elk season. We'll talk about your views on calling and so on and so forth. I'd like to get your insight on that for sure.
Right on. I look forward to it.
All right, buddy. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, John. Have a good one.
Hey guys, if you're looking for a really good hunt, every year, my outfitting service, Days in the Wild, we take out a handful of clients for deer and javelina in the archery season and rifle seasons here. It's too late to get a rifle tag now for deer, but the draw is opening for javelina, and if you want to get a rifle tag for javelina, or you'd like to come out and do a combination archery javelina hunt, archery deer and javelina hunt, give me a shout. Hit me up on Instagram or Facebook or hit me up on the blog, or go to our website, daysinthewild.com, and contact us through there. We can talk about it and build you your hunt of your, I don't know, I want to say of your dreams, but definitely an awesome time and lots of action and really true Western experience where you're getting to do a lot of spot and stalk, getting to navigate the mountains. It's a good time. Great weather that time of year. Most of our hunts take place in December and January for the deer and javelina combination. And if you're coming just for javelina, those are typically in February. So give us a shout, and we'll put together a great hunt for you. Thanks.